Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times correspondent Neil McFarquhar knew the Middle East, lived in the Arab world years before his first reporting assignment. He grew up as a boy in a seaside compound for American oil workers in Libya, thought of it as home before he thought of it as a war zone of arms or ideas. Now he's written a book about the everyday Arab world as he knows it. This hour on Point, Neil McFarquhar on life in the Arab world beyond the headlines. You can join the conversation. Is there another Middle East to call on, draw on, beyond the endless headlines of conflict, or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Neil McFarquhar. He grew up in Libya, covered the region for the Associated Press, including stints in Israel and Kuwait. From 2001 through 2005, he was Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times. He now covers the UN for the Times. His new book is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Neil McFarquhar, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You say you wrote this book, or maybe to begin with, you went back and dove into reporting as an adult in the Middle East, in part as a kind of atonement, I guess, for a youth there that's fascinating in itself. You tell us, atonement for what?
Well, I mean, it was an idyllic childhood. I basically grew up in Club Med, or maybe I should call it Texas on the Mediterranean, because we lived right on the beach. But it was an oil town. And in the early years, the Libyans were not actually allowed to live in the town. They were allowed in. The laborers were allowed in during the day.
What years?
But they had we moved there in 1965, and that was, and then when Gaddafi overthrew the king, he changed that rule. And I mean, I think a mark of our isolation is that we found out that there had been a coup in Libya from the radio. You know, every morning I sat at the kitchen table with my father and ate cornflakes, and we listened to the BBC News, and the chimes of Big Ben ended one morning, and then, you know, the first headline was there, you know, there's been a coup in Libya. Muammar Gaddafi has seized power. And we were like, really?
Not here. Our cornflakes are still fresh.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was no peep from the town because there were no Libyans in it, and we just had no interaction. And so I sort of felt by the time I got to college, I sort of, you know, was wondering about the society around me that I had grown up in, and, you know, what was on the other side of that fence. And so I decided to become a reporter and go back and find out.
You know, I wish you'd just stick with us for a second there on that Libyan coast, because in a way your life there seems to me to find a lot of American interactions with the Arab world before the era that we're in right now. I mean, here you're talking the mid-1960s. Your father's a chemical engineer for Esso, which was, I guess, the world's biggest at that time. What was that like? I mean, what interaction did you have with the local population? What was the conversation of Americans about Libyans in your little world at that time? What was your life, your family's life like there?
You know, I mean, we sort of follow the same rhythms as any kind of American community, you know, but there was a little bit of a twist. You know, we'd have a Christmas pageant, but they would build a real manger with real palm fronds, and they'd bring in Libyans to take care of the cows and sheep that were in the manger. And of course, there were some Libyan engineers in training there. So, you know, we did have some interaction, but it was really because they weren't allowed to live there. Nobody came there with their families. And I went to, you know, Esso Elementary School. But it was an American school. You know, we had softball league and we played football, and we had school pageants and Easter egg hunts and did everything. And occasionally the school would, you know, throw a play or something that tried to connect with the local culture. But, you know, Libya was a Roman colony. And so if we did a play, it would usually be about Septimus Severus, one of the Roman emperors that happened to be born in Libya. We never really sort of touched on the Arab or Islamic culture around us.
A Roman colony 2,000 years earlier. I mean, your life there as Americans in that oil setting seemed colonial in itself.
I guess, I mean, it wasn't colonial, I don't think, in the same sense of sort of the British Raj, in that there was no kind of overlording over anybody or we were just isolated. You know, I mean, we had a fantastic beach. It's one of the prettiest beaches I've ever seen in my life, if not the prettiest. And, you know, every afternoon after school, I would go run down and sail. And, you know, we had a Boy Scout troop, and we'd take these fantastic expeditions out into the desert. And there's
which
know,
was right behind you, the Mediterranean on one side, and right behind you, that Sahara.
Yeah, I was like it was like landscape of the moon almost. But as a kid, like there was a plateau about 60 miles south of us, and that whole area of the Sahara was very low lying and had been underwater once. So you could go up on this plateau, and you know, as a little kid, I'd scrabble around in the rocks, and you'd find like shark's teeth, which was just such a thrill. And occasionally, in the Boy Scouts, we'd take expeditions out into the desert and find like old American World War II bombers that had crashed, and you know, it was just it was an adventure.
Did you think of yourself as a young Lawrence of Arabia in the making? I mean, did you imagine yourself, you know, spending a lifetime interacting with that bigger Arab world or staying on your side of the fence?
We didn't really interact very much with them. You know, there was a crossroads outside the town that kind of sprung up, and there was a bakery out there that made, you know, fresh bread, one of the sort of hangovers of the Libya being an Italian colony, as they had fantastic fresh, you know, loaves of bread. And so we'd go up there and, you know, you talk to the Libyans a little bit. And it was mandated. The one thing that was mandated was that we take Arabic in school. But the oil company decided that that would be a great way to get a promising engineer who had bad English to improve his English. Mm. So they changed the teacher every year. And so, of course, you know, the teacher would come in and he'd say, did you learn the alphabet last year? And we'd all have already decided we were going to tell him no. So we'd all shake our little blonde head and say, no, didn't learn the alphabet. And then we'd start over, Alif Bet, and we'd all get really good grades every year. Now it seems like this horrible waste. But at the time, of course, it was a great game.
So as you look at your career, I mean, later you were in all kinds of zones of conflict. It was anything but a gated community. You write about your lives and headlines being gated by violence itself in a way. But and we'll hear lots of anecdotes from your life and work there. But how do you think that this particular beginning affects your perspective on the Middle East today, starting out in that kind of, gilded cage in a way, not exactly a rich life? Libyans, you write themselves, were sort of astounded when they, under Gaddafi, finally came into your compound at how humble some things were. But how do you think it's affected your perspective on that part of the world beginning as you did?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention Gaddafi because I sort of, when I look back at the region, you know, he was there from almost my earliest memory. So sometimes I feel like there's two people left in the Middle East from my Libyan boyhood, Gaddafi and me.
Good buddies.
Not exactly, but he did come in and inspect the houses at one point because everybody complained that they had been given inferior houses.
The Libyans when they finally moved into the compound alongside. They thought, it's got to be better than this. Yes. They weren't living in mansions?
Exactly. Where's the swimming pool?
Yeah.
So he, of course, came roaring down there thinking, I'm going to solve this colonial hangover, and discovered that all the houses were exactly the same. And there were no sumptuous villas. But I think, to your larger point, I think it did give me a certain fondness and empathy for the region. You know, I'm certainly aware that, you know, of the wackiness of Libya and the venality of Gaddafi's long rule. But I think that I sort of can relate to people a little better just because I've spent so much time there and because I did go back and learn the language.
You start off making the case in this book that we may miss the region, miss the people and their heart if we only see the headlines of violence and conflict. And yet the further I read into it, those headlines and the realities behind them loom awfully large here also, you know, up against the lovely nights way back when in the Bekaa Valley or, you know, you name it, those sweeter moments. Boy, those headlines loom large.
There's no question that you know, violence shapes a lot in the region, and certainly more than when I was a boy. But I think that, you know, I was in a dinner in San Francisco, and a woman at the dinner with me turned to me, and she asked me a question that just startled me. She said, aren't there any normal people in the Middle East, or at least, you know, people like you and me, or at least people we can relate to or empathize with? And I was kind of shocked, and I guess I felt a little sense of responsibility just because I kind of went back through my head. I mean, my immediate answer was, of course, all kinds. I've got great friends. And then I sort of thought about what I write about most of the time. And I landed there back as a correspondent in 1988. And so I did the first Gulf War. I did various Palestinian uprisings against the Israeli occupation. I did the fallout from 9/11. I did the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, so what emerges is this sort of image of mass gunmen and veiled women who, if they weren't mute, would say, rescue me. And I, you know, I think that's a mistake. So I tried to go back and I spent time with the most famous chef. I spent time with a sex therapist. I spent time with Fairuz, who's the, you know, beloved diva in Lebanon and the region, who's also played Vegas. So I think there is another side that we don't talk enough about.
And if we knew it? If we knew it better?
Well, I think it would help the region sort of to an extent because I think there are people working for change and there are people that are as appalled in the area by the violence. And certainly, you know, the people in that area are the main victims of the violence. I mean, certainly the political kind of Islam would there are much more Muslim victims and much more Arab victims than there are in other parts of the world, but they have these kind of venal political systems. And so I think if people talked to and spoke to the people trying to bring change, it would fortify them and it would help them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Arab world behind the battle lines with Neil McFarquhar, longtime Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times, grew up on the shores of Libya, his father a chemical engineer for a big American oil company there, spent a lot of time for the Associated Press all over the region in war and peace and time of protest. He's out with a new book called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Neil McFarquhar joins us from New York. And Neil, I wish you'd just begin to take us on a tour of unexpected encounters here. Dive in anywhere you like, but show us some of those moments that we may have missed in all the reporting we know so well.
Well, I think I'll start with the title, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, because I get asked a lot where it came up with. And it actually, when you work in Hezbollah-controlled territory, which is basically the southern neighborhoods of Beirut or South Lebanon, they ask you to fill out a form, and they ask you where you went to college, what your mother's name is, and your birthday. And then suddenly these birthday notices, emails actually from Hezbollah would pop into my inbox on my birthday every year. And so I think the point of that title is that there are, you know, we kind of in the United States sometimes we get caught up in this bickering of, you know, is it a terrorist organization or is it a social service agency? And that just goes around and around in circles. And I think what we miss is why they're successful, and we don't pay enough attention to that. And the example I use in the book is sort of a dairy cow program. The United States aid agency was trying to get hashish farmers to stop growing hashish, and so they started selling dairy cows in Lebanon. This is in the Bekaa Valley, which was, you know, during the Civil War was an area of a lot of violence. And so they were trying to stop the hashish farming. And of course, you know, the hashish farmers loved the Americans because they used to just sort of land planes and bring Smith & Wesson pistols and take off again with their planes packed with hashish. And they were like, that was really good American.
I guess you're talking about American drug dealers who were doing that.
American drug dealers.
Oh, our favorite Americans.
So they were thought – and then, you know, so – and then the dairy cows came along and you know, the U.S. sold them the dairy cows at $1,900 a piece.
This was foreign aid?
This was foreign aid. And they, you know, they chipped in maybe $1 million to help with feed and stuff like that. But, you know, the American dairy cows had a hard time adapting to the Bekaa Valley, and they would get sick and stuff. And so along comes Hezbollah with their television station, which is called El Menor. And every time there was a sick a dairy cow, they would run over there with a camera and say, look at these terrible cows that the Americans are dumping on us. And they convinced the Iranians to send them cheaper cows. And they were trying to say that the Iranian cows were, you know. So I think that's just one example of how that sort of superpower competition actually works on the ground for, you know, ordinary farmers.
Not necessarily at the level of high ideology or certainly not clash of civilizations, just who's going to help me out here with a cow that I can milk productively in the Bekaa Valley.
Exactly. But and you know, I think that one of the reasons that Hezbollah is probably going to do well in the upcoming elections is because they do pay a lot of attention to that sort of social service stuff, you know, hospitals, clinics, farm outreach that the government neglects.
You spend a good deal of time talking about the famous singer in the Arab world, Fairuz, and her grip on the imagination of people. You go to a concert there by the pyramids in Egypt, which is kind of remarkable. Follow her all the way to Las Vegas, and it's another sort of angle into the emotional, cultural life of the region.
It is, and it's also, sort of she was the symbol of Lebanon as the crossroads of East and West, because her fame started in the Bekaa Valley at a famous music festival that they had there every year. And, she was discovered in 1957, and it was this, Lebanon was trying to sell itself as the crossroads, and she kind of embodied that because she sings Arabic poetry, but in kind of a Western way.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about my childhood there, and I had always had this kind of idealized image of Lebanon and of Fayrouz. I have this great picture of my parents at the Casino de Liban, which is still there, a very fancy casino outside Beirut from 1974. And I think that tension in the Middle East between, whether it's going to try and be cosmopolitan and outward-looking and a crossroads, or inward-looking and kind of muscular power, domestic power, is the tension between modernity and tradition that still plays out there.
Describe that night by the pyramids where she's coming for a concert in Egypt. People are excited out of their minds, and it's not about a political message, though there is a kind of maybe Arab nationalism or pride over Fayrouz there. But I thought just the scene and the interaction of high and low in society of the concert promoters and the Egyptian government was quite telling.
It was an amazing concert because it was in 1989, and she had boycotted, along with the rest of the Arab world, Egypt for signing the peace treaty with Israel.
Mm.
And it was the first time she had sung since the boycott started. And it was also the first time, because there was a peace treaty, that Israeli Arabs, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship could come over the border. And, about 1,000 came, or, I think there was 30 buses or so. Mm. And they love her because a lot of her songs are sort of considered anthems of Palestinian suffering. So they wanted to show up. And so when the Egyptian government saw all these people showing up, they jacked up the tax bill. Mm. And the promoter just printed a bunch of new tickets. and they all said front section. So everybody thought that they had a front row seat. And so they showed up at 11.
PM.
When the concert was supposed to start. 11 p.m. was the concert. Yeah, it's right underneath the pyramids. It was actually right underneath the nose of the Sphinx. So they all show up, and, there's not enough seats, and they keep filling the place and filling the place, and they filled all the aisles. And, I was kind of worried if there was a fire, you would have never been able to get out there. But I think the more imminent danger was a riot, because at about 1 o'clock, they were still pouring in, and the promoter comes out and says, "We've discovered the problem. There's a Zionist plot to destroy this concert," and, which is this ridiculous excuse that they use for everything, even when the weather goes wrong. So people were just yelling at him. But then she came on stage at about 2, and she sang for 2 hours, and she's a beautiful singer. And when they all went home at dawn, they forgot all about the chaos and just said that the concert was a resounding success.
You describe the kind of euphoria that took over that crowd under the crumbled nose of the Sphinx there in the Egyptian desert, listening to Fayrouz. Give us a sense of what's bringing out the passion. What's the message? Is it an angry political message? Anthems of Palestinian suffering. Is it something deeper than that? And how might it matter to Americans what that crowd was responding to there with Fayrouz?
No, I think they were responding to her because a lot of the things talk about village life. I went back to my village. I found my old house. I saw my old vineyard. Or there's a song about Beirut. It says, it's to Beirut with its face like an old fisherman. She kind of speaks to a nostalgia that they all have for a simpler time in the region and for, more peaceful region, less fraught with violence. And I think that gets back to my main point in the book is that, people there do want a simpler life, an easier life, and I really try and describe some of that, and also I try and talk about the interplay between sort of the outside image and the daily reality that people live.
Neil McFarquhar is with us. His new book is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah. Wishes you a happy birthday. He joins us from New York. And Neil, we've got callers with questions for you from around the country. Let's go to Lansing, Michigan. And Tony, hi, Tony. You're on the air with Neil McFarquhar.
Thanks for taking the call. I noticed that we tend to get clips of quote, normal Mideasterners only when they're in a situation of violence, for example, in the news. And when we see them in other situations, they use similar language to the language we have piled on us of terrorist talking, like they'll say Allah permitting. And so I'm wondering to what extent your guest sees our inability to understand the culture as one of the biggest reasons that even if we do see a normal daily scene, we can't tell that that's what it is.
You've got terrorists beseeching Allah for help, and then ordinary people praying to Allah. It's confusing. What do you say, Neil?
Thanks for the question, Tony. I think that, you know, it comes back to the point that I was referring to earlier, you know, the image and the reality. First of all, they are very religious in a way that a lot of the parts of the world aren't. So God does come up in conversation a lot. But in that sort of outside versus inside thing, I'll take the example of fatwas. There's a whole chapter of fatwas in the thing. And, of course, the most famous one was the one from Ayatollah Khomeini against Salman Rushdie for his book, The Satanic Verses. And, you know, a lot of people have the impression that all fatwas are about death sentences, but they're not. They're about, you know, daily problems of people ask their clerics for rulings about what they should do in their sex lives. They ask about their political lives. They ask about their business life. And, you know, there's all sorts of issues that come up. My favorite one was in Iran, and it's in the book, and it's like, you know, dogs are considered unclean in Islam. And so since the Islamic Revolution in Iran wanted to create this idyllic society, every once in a while they try and ban dogs. And, you know, the clerics will fulminate against, you know, the horrible sight of men holding short-legged dogs and how it's a disgrace to the revolution. And then it's created this black market in dogs. Where I went down to the dog market or the animal market, and people would come sidling up to me and say, "Hey, you want a German Shepherd? I got a German Shepherd. You want to buy one?" And so I think that you're right, Tony, and that I think a lot of the image about daily life comes in the context of violence. And I think that's why it's important to take a further step back and just to try and find ways to talk about things like fatwas that tell people about how the society works on an ordinary basis.
We're working on that right here. Tony, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Harwinton, Connecticut, and Victoria. Hi, Victoria. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I was married to a Kuwaiti and lived in Kuwait. I taught English at a woman's teacher's college in 1970. I'm still friends with my ex and many Kuwaitis. And Kuwait is a good example of a really wonderful, moderate Arab country. And I'm continually astounded at how, after all these years and even having a war there, throwing Saddam Hussein out, that Americans still absolutely categorically do not know any difference between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. I always get the same response of that, you know, I was imprisoned like Saudi Arabia and couldn't drive cars, et cetera, et cetera. And it couldn't be further from the truth. I had as much freedom in Kuwait as I did, you know, anywhere else, and was very well treated. And the Kuwaitis are just a super group of people, and we don't hear about them, and we don't, the media doesn't pay attention to the more moderate groups of Arabs, and are only focusing on the others. And the other thing I just want to quickly say is that the irony of talking about Firouz is that I happen to look like Firouz, and when I was
the
in
great
Kuwait,
singer.
They always thought I was from Lebanon, because there are groups of red-headed Lebanese that people don't realize. And that was always very helpful.
Victoria, let me ask you, though. We'll put it to Neil McFarquhar, but are you then saying, though, I mean, he's saying look into the real life in a lot of these countries and you're going to see recognizable human emotions and so on, but are you saying Kuwait good, Saudi Arabia bad? That's a big country to write off.
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia is a completely, Saudi Arabia, particularly from a woman's point of view, is just ghastly. And my, and their lack of freedom, my ex-husband, when the war in Kuwait broke out, he flew to Saudi Arabia, and they wouldn't let him out of the airport because 10 years prior to that, he had written a critical article on the Saudi royal family. So that not only, it's not just women, their lack of freedom and the way they handle it is really ghastly. And I think we have to differentiate between those countries, even though we need Saudi oil. And there's been a kind of a whitewashing of all the problems. There's a huge, huge difference between ordinary life in Saudi Arabia and ordinary life in Kuwait.
Victoria, thanks for your call. Neil, what do you make? Victoria says, please differentiate. But then when she does differentiate, she writes off a pretty good-sized country. I mean, or you hear her critique.
I You know, I'm glad she brought up Kuwait, and I agree with her to an extent. We tend to treat the whole area as completely monolithic, and there are enormous differences from one country to the next. And I lived in Kuwait for a year after the first Gulf War, and one of the favorite Kuwaitis I ever met was Fawzia Duray, and she's in the book. And
sex
she's a sex therapist.
Yeah.
She's a sex columnist, and she now has actually a sex show, or it's called The Biography of Love. It's a cable show. And, you know, I kind of express, because she's a veiled woman, but on the show she wears like long red leather skirts and a matching red headscarf. And I was like, aren't people, you know, kind of uncomfortable with the idea of a religious or a devout woman talking about sex? And she said, are you kidding? A veiled woman talking about sex? They love it, sweetie. And she's just really vivid and very open about, you know, what she talks about. And, you know, it sometimes kind of causes a scandal within the country. And she certainly has her detractors, but she keeps at it. And, you know, the point Victoria was making about Saudi Arabia is also true to an extent. I mean, it is one of the hardest, most repressive countries to work in. And at the same time, there are many Saudis who are absolutely charming, and they are among the most generous people, you know, you meet. And I would show up in the country, and I'd call people, and like 10 pounds of dates would arrive in my hotel room, and people were constantly inviting me out of dinner. So the saving grace in working in such a sort of closed country was that there were a lot of people that are charming. But it is a very difficult place to live, especially for women.
What does it mean then in the end? I mean, you're reminding us of folks in this region are human like us. You're reminding us of their humanity. At the same time, Victoria, and you point to all that's really tough about Saudi Arabia to take from maybe an American cultural perspective. So does that mean, you know, is it a kumbaya message? If we all just knew each other better, everything would be fine, or not really?
I think that you have to sort of take those societies as they are and just try and figure out, you know, the good and the bad. I mean, certainly, you know, we sometimes forget in the United States that people look at sort of the number of people that die in gun violence here, and we can't quite believe it. But we all, you know, live here and we love this country. And, you know, I think that the same is true in Saudi Arabia. And I think perhaps one of my favorite, you know, I did go back to learn the language. And I think one of the most difficult aspects of living in Saudi Arabia is that they have sort of religious police there, you know, that kind of make sure that the tenets of Islam are enforced. And, you know, that's very hard on the women. And you know, I go into the book, it was hard to find, but I found a woman who had, you know, been sort of beaten up and imprisoned by the religious police because she was in an office surrounded by men she wasn't married or related to. So there are certainly dark aspects of those societies, but that doesn't mean there aren't people trying to work to change that and you know, to make them better.
We're talking this hour with Neil McFarquhar, longtime correspondent in the Middle East. We'll go out with some music from Fairuz, the diva he writes up so fascinatingly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the Arab world behind the battle lines with longtime New York Times and Associated Press correspondent Neil McFarquhar. He now covers the United Nations for the New York Times, joins us from New York. His new book is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Let's get a call from just around the corner here, Lexington, Massachusetts, and Robin. Hi, Robin. You're on the air with Neil McFarquhar.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Neil. I heard earlier in the interview Neil say that he felt like he and Gaddafi were the only ones left from the era when he was in Libya. But I was there with my family in Benghazi and then later in Marsa El Brega. My father was a pipeline engineer with Exxon. And I just remembered the name of Farquhar sounded familiar, and I thought I'd call in and see if perhaps he had been in Benghazi or Marcel Brega.
You think you were playing on the same beach? What do you say, Neil?
I was in Benghazi. I mean, I was about three when we were in Benghazi, so I remember the zoo and my pet donkey, and that's about it. And Marcel Brega, we lived in for years. Yes, we were the 17th family to move in there.
Do you look back on it fondly, Robin? And is it fondly because you lived, you know, fenced off from hard stuff?
You know, I'm sorry. I'm in the car, and so I'm not getting excellent reception. But that's amazing that we were in Marcel Braga probably until 67. I graduated from high school in 65, so I guess I'm a little older than Neil. But anyhow.
great old days on the oil coast of Libya. Robin, thank you very much. I don't want you to get in trouble with your car phone there, but thank you for calling. Let's get one from Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What do you know, Michael?
Well, actually, I was calling because I watch your show every... I mean, I listen to your show every day, so it's, you know, I've always wanted to call, and this is a subject matter that I actually have experience with. And
great. What do you know?
I'm an American convert to Islam. And in 2005, 2006, I went to the pilgrimage to Mecca. And after that, I went and spent time in Doha, Qatar. And it was a great experience. The people in the Middle East pride themselves on hospitality. So, like, everywhere we went, especially when they saw that we were American, we were Muslim, they were trying to come eat at my house, come eat at my house, and, you know, taking us everywhere, telling us about their families, take you back five or six generations through their families. It was, you know, it was a great experience. It was very clean, especially in Doha. The whole city was very clean. The people were, I mean, it was just phenomenal.
It must have been quite a journey, the Hajj and all the rest. What led you to convert to Islam, Michael?
Well, I was actually, I'm a history and student. I mean, I'm a student of history and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in the church in Alabama, so it's a big-time Bible Belt.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, I was the youth minister at his church. And I just kept studying the different religions and stuff like that because I wanted to know about the different cultures. And finally, I just liked Islam better.
Hey, it's a free country. And it sounds like you had a great experience traveling in the region. Neil, what about it? Here's an American who becomes a Muslim, has a wonderful time traveling in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. Is there an inside-outside factor at play here, or is it hospitality there for anyone?
I think the hospitality is for anyone. I mean, I think it's one of the hallmarks of the area is that they really do treat... I mean, as an American, people always ask me, well, you know, didn't you run into trouble as an American? And, I look like everybody's kind of cliche of an American, at least from their point of view. I'm 6'3", and I'm blonde, so I don't fit in at all. And the only year that I had sort of that I would run up against people being hostile towards me and never... overtly, and certainly not to the degree that reporters were in Iraq, but it was that year of the invasion when there were a lot of American soldiers shown on TV all the time invading Iraq. Then, you know, people would throw things at me. Or, you know, sometimes they'd make a joke out of it. I broke a tooth in Saudi Arabia once, and I had to go to a dental clinic that I'd never been to before, and I was sitting in the chair. And I was asking the dentist where he was from because I wanted to know his medical background. And, you know, he said, well, I'm from Syria, et cetera. And he said, you know, and so he's playing with the drill. And he said, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from New York. And he said, American. That's not a very popular thing to be. Open wide.
Oh, watch out. Here comes the drill.
But he did a great job.
Well, Michael traveled as a Muslim American. You traveled as a Christian American. What if you'd been a Jewish American traveling in these same trails?
You know, I have a lot of colleagues who are Jewish, and I don't think occasionally they run into problems. But I think by and large that people don't discriminate. I think Americans in general, I mean, considering, you know, how angry people get about American policy in the region, I think journalists, you know, with the notable section of the terrible problems they've had in Iraq, are generally treated pretty well.
Let's go to Omar in Fall River, Massachusetts. Omar, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you see, Omar?
Yeah, I love your show, and I listen to it almost every day.
That's great.
And it's a very, very important show because it's a show with a diverse knowledge of the world, and it teaches people a lot.
We try. Teach us something, Omar. What do you see on this subject?
Yeah, it's very important. That prompted me to call because what happened is... If you look at the world today, I think there must be a sense of acceptance for different heterogeneous cultures around the world. Because if you look at the culture of the United States and Europe, they're kind of similar. That's why they get along easily.
Mm.
You look at the one for Asia, they're kind of neutral. Africa, they're kind of neutral.
Mm.
And then you look at the Middle East, you know, they're kind of neutral too. So we must understand everyone's culture and try to accept it. I think that will make the world safer. And there's another thing. If you look at the Palestinians today and the Israel's problem today, I think the United States stand as a as an intermediary for these two people. And I think the Arab people, most of them, feel that there's a bias between them and Israel from the United States. Because if you see, I talked to one guy from Palestinian, from Palestine, and he was telling me that why should they allow Israel having the nuclear weapon and Palestine wouldn't? And I think, to my own point of view, there should be a Palestinian nation to make them responsible people. But if they leave them like that, they end up being like criminals. They're not responsible for anything. They will be. I think if they put them together as a nation, there will be no more room for terrorists.
Omar, you've put a lot on the table, and we thank you for it. Neil McFarquhar, what about to the first point? Omar, you know, says, look, we've got to try to understand and accept one another as cultures. With that equation, understanding equals acceptance. Do you see that? What about the clash of civilizations argument here? Do you really think that more understanding would mean more acceptance? Or sometimes it's presented to us, it would mean the opposite.
You know, certainly the way the Iraq invasion unrolled and things like that makes people sort of, you know, there are a lot of violent aspects of the region that make people shy away. But I think, again, the point that I'm trying to make in the book is that you kind of trying to see things from people's perspective there. And the biggest example that I can come up with is like Al Jazeera, the satellite network. And it's kind of vilified in the United States because we know it here as kind of the platform that Osama bin Laden uses to make his messages. But if you look at it from the regional point of view, I mean, how they see it, it's kind of busted open the conversation there in a way that could have never happened before. And all the governments in the area hate it because Al Jazeera always digs up these obscure opposition figures, you know, Libyan people who've been writing against Gaddafi and living in London for 10 years, or people who hate Hosni, the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, or who think that the royal family in Saudi Arabia are a bunch of, you know, corrupt thieves, and they put them on the air. And, you know, as a correspondent, it was like night and day, my working there in the pre-Jazeera era and the after, because I would keep it on in my hotel room all the time because they're really fast and really good with breaking news, and they always find really good critics of the regimes in the area that they're reporting about. And that kind of gets lost in the conversation because the news that creeps out is that they've got the latest tape from Osama bin Laden. So I think, you know, you need to look at how the region works a little bit and then you understand it better.
And what about Omar raises Israelis and Palestinians and the seemingly interminable conflict there? When you bring this perspective, the perspectives of this book, of your work, I guess, to this particular problem, how does it light it up? Does it light it up differently than the headlines might normally?
Well, there's no question that their Arab perception that the U.S. favors Israel on all topics colors a lot of American relations with the region. But I lived in Jerusalem in 1993. I moved there for a couple of years, which was right when the peace agreement worked out by the Norwegians sort of came into effect. And I had a Thanksgiving dinner. And I talk about, you know, cooking Thanksgiving dinner for all sides in that book. And I think that was really a moment of hope because people sort of thought that there was a way that everybody could get along. And I think that there is a constituency that will accept the other side on both sides. But it takes political will and it takes political leaders to kind of push that along, and we have not had very good ones on any side in that case.
But, you know, with the title of your book about the birthday greetings here, and you quote them, this is the email birthday greetings from Hezbollah. Dear Neil, on your birthday, I wish you all the joy your heart can hold, all the smiles a day can bring, all the blessings life unfold. May you have God's best in everything. And it's happy birthday from Haidar Dikmak from Media Relations Hezbollah. But, you know, just a few pages later, you're describing TV shows put on El Menar where they're celebrating suicide bombers. It's not exactly a Hallmark card greeting a suicide bomber.
It's not. And, you know, I'm not trying to gloss over the violence or the horrific aspects of the, you know, some of the organizations and some of the political players in that region. But I think if you look at others and people trying to create change, then you help develop a counterweight to those kinds of organizations.
Let's get a call from Augusta, Georgia. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I was calling about the caller earlier, Michael from Alabama, the convert. I was kind of not shocked to hear that he was treated well by other Muslims, because once they hear you're a Muslim, and of course he's a male, he fits the two major criteria that receives less of the harshness of being American or being a non-Muslim. So I wasn't very shocked to hear that. And since I was over there as a linguist for the military, and I met all walks of life.
Where, Chris? In Iraq or elsewhere?
Well, we're not over there.
Okay.
The Iraq War, but over Iraq.
Okay, okay.
But I was going to say that the governments are the ones, you know, the more strict, the more laws they have, the less, and these countries have very, very bad policing compared to ours. Hmm. The more laws you have, of course, they're going to break them. So you're going to have extreme left and extreme right as far as following the rules and not. So we could just really sum it up by looking at how do the governments make the laws? Are they one-sided? And how do they police them?
And do you see what? If the Americans understood, knew the Arab world better, do you see a path toward a more harmonious relation, Chris, having or not?
The general American, no. Our government knows more about over there than I do, and I was over there and I studied their culture just enough to translate.
Yep.
But as far as the general American, there's really not much impact we're going to have other than be a wary traveler. But I think it's really up to the governments to kind of get with the times and stop being traditionalists and looking into laws that were written or made up thousands of years ago. So there's really not much the American person can do.
Chris, thanks very much for your call. Let me get one more here from Bolton, from Corey in Vermont. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just thought it'd be worthwhile mentioning Edward Said and his theory of Orientalism in the way that much of the Middle East is perceived and propagated to the American people through mass media. I'll take my call off here. Thanks.
Thank you, Corey. Neil, what do you say to Chris, who was there with the U.S. military, to Corey, who's thinking of Edward Said and Orientalism?
I think that the Orientalism argument, I think in the Media Relations Department of Hezbollah wishes you a happy birthday. I'm really trying to present a side of it that's not sort of the caricature and to look at how the conversations that Arabs have among themselves. And Chris's point is also well taken in terms of the laws in that, you know, there are a lot of the laws over there, but there isn't sort of any enforcement. And, in part of the book, I profile about half a dozen men and women in different countries that are all trying to fight aspects of that. I mean, I look at the situation in Jordan with the secret police, because secret police control virtually every Arab society and, you know, the problems that people have with that. I talk about the fact that they're all laws, but, you know, if you're the king of Morocco, for example, you can ignore the laws and write them at your will. It's about, I spent a lot of time with a political prisoner, a young army soldier who was thrown into jail for more than 18 years for having a minor role in a military coup just because the king was mad. Mm. So there are issues of political change that I delve into in the book that, again, you know, there are some brave men and women kind of trying to push change and make them countries of law. And I think in the United States, people can speak out about, you know, the importance of civil society, not single out any country or not single out any individuals, but just talk about the principles, and that would help people working for change.
You right at the front of the book quote the Quran saying, "Verily, never will Allah change the condition of a people until they change it themselves." Is that a hope? Is that an expectation? Is this a hopeful perspective you bring, Neil, or not?
I think, you know, there are people, I mean, they are working against terrible odds. And certainly, you know, the past has not always given them encouragement. But I think people who are working for change should be encouraged.
Neil McFarquhar's new book is The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. Neil, thank you very much for sharing all those years of experience, all those great stories with us. And it's great speaking with you today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Tom.
Neil McFarquhar of the New York Times. You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. لما